The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Sally Blesdek. I am a member of the George S. Pepper Society Council and a proud supporter of this great library. If you haven't explored the Free Library in a while, I encourage you to take the time to discover all it has to offer in addition to the wonderful author event series. For example, the Julie Dannenbaum Culinary Arts Collection, housed here at the Parkway Central, features everything from wine guides and beer brewing manuals to regional and ethnic cuisine, cookbooks, and bread baking recipes. If you're looking for inspiration in the kitchen, I highly recommend exploring this great collection. Superb, stellar, attractive and appetizing, lively, practical, and passionate. These words and phrases have been used to describe the latest books from our acclaimed guests this evening. Food writers Amanda Hesser, Mather Jaffrey, and Judith Jones, bringing their unique perspectives and knowledge to the world of gastronomy, these women stand at the apex of culinary and literary achievement. A food writer and columnist for more than a decade at the New York Times, the award-winning writer Amanda Hesser studied cooking in Europe and worked in restaurants and bakeries across the continent. She tested and updated the more than 1,000 recipes included in the essential New York Times cookbook just released, all of which were first published in the New York Times. Mather Jaffrey helped make the intricate flavors of South Asian cuisine accessible to the home cook through her television programs like Flavors of India, her cookbooks such as An Invitation to Indian Cooking and From Curries to Kebabs. Six of her cookbooks received the prestigious James Beard Award. In At Home with Mather Jaffrey, she deconstructs several classic Indian dishes and encourages readers to incorporate easy South Asian cooking into their everyday repertoire. Ms. Hesser and Ms. Jaffrey will be in conversation tonight with the legendary Judith Jones, a senior editor and vice president at Alfred A. Knopf. She has edited some of the most significant cookbooks of our time, including Julia Child's classic, Mastering the Art of French Cooking. Her new book, The Pleasures of Cooking for One, presents a wealth of kitchen wisdom and a variety of recipes for the solitary chef. We are honored to have them here this evening with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Amanda Hesser, Mather Jaffrey, and Judith Jones.
Tonight, we're going to sort of explore American attitudes towards food, what the food revolution is and its impact, and just good stories about food. It is a phenomenon that in the last 50 years we have gone from having that sort of Puritan attitude towards food. I think of my own family and my mother. I wrote her a letter once from Paris and said, "I know you didn't send me to an expensive college to cook, but," and then I started telling her about the French attitude towards food. And so we've seen enormous changes. In fact, they've gone by so quickly that we haven't had time to really talk about them as much as we'd like to. So we have Mather here and Amanda here, and I'm going to throw out a few questions, and then we're really going to just have a conversation, and you can join in. What would you consider the food revolution was? I know that you came to America in the late 50s and that it was a wilderness compared to what it is today, and particularly in your area. So do you want to sort of tell us about
what I consider the food revolution to be? Well, it has had many, many stages, and what was bad once is now good again. When I came on the Queen Mary to America, and I landed in New York, in the harbor, passing the Statue of Liberty and waving to the Statue of Liberty. And when I came, very shortly thereafter, when I got interested in food, among the things that I was told was that iceberg lettuce is completely no-no. It's not what proper people should be eating. And when I came on this Queen Mary, the most exciting, there were two things. I'd never been on the Queen Mary before, so that was an adventure in itself. And as I explored the dining room and the food that I was fed and the people that I looked around at, I said, these are the Americans that I'm going to be living with probably for the rest of my life. And who are they? What do they like? I was examining them. And the one thing that I loved, I fell in love with instantly, was iceberg lettuce. And it was offered to us big wedges of it, which I had never seen. In India, the lettuce is soft. We don't have this kind of crisp, very crisp lettuce. So I just fell in love with the texture. I fell in love with iceberg lettuce. And then the other thing that I saw that I did not fall in love with, which everybody was wearing, was Bermuda shorts. So I said, okay, this is one aspect of America I don't like. I do like this. Then I come and settle down and eventually get into the world of food, and then the first thing I hear is that you can't eat iceberg. It's not the thing to do. It's like iceberg lettuce. So I was very, very upset about that. And several years later, when I got to know James Beard through Judith, James said to me, he said, I like iceberg lettuce.
Good for him.
I do too. And so we quietly, the two of us, would sit and eat wedges of iceberg lettuce, leaving the rest of the world to eat properly. So that was one aspect of the so-called revolution which I saw starting at that time. But it was certainly taking a form that I did not understand at all. It was to take other forms later, but we can talk about them. I don't want to hog the microphone. Mm-hmm. So please.
Okay.
I was thinking about you brought this up. That I mean, I feel like it's just been this kind of like constantly snowballing thing. It hasn't been like one distinct period. And there's a recipe in the New York Times called Heavenly Hots. And do you know Heavenly Hots?
Oh, I know Heavenly Hots.
Yeah, it's a great recipe name, and it's a pancake, believe it or not. And and it's this kind of like souffle / bellini like pancake with a lot of sour cream, a lot of eggs, very little flour. It's just kind of barely held together by flour. And it was served at the Bridge Creek Restaurant in California in like the 70s and 80s, and it appeared in the Times in the 80s. And John Hitzfeth, the owner of the restaurant, who he loved the Heavenly Hots so much, he named his company Heavenly Hots, Inc. And he said, oh, you know, we did this crazy thing. We served them with maple syrup, which was unheard of in California. And it just it made me think about revolution. Well, of course, it was kind of revolutionary to be serving ingredients that were not local to you. And now, of course, we've gone right back to, like, you shouldn't be serving maple syrup in California.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing that happened as soon as I came to this country was because it was soon the 60s, and there was this rush for health food, whatever that means, and there were health food restaurants all over the city. In the village there were lots, in the East Village there were lots of restaurants, and I said, I should try this health food. I came from a very healthy country, but I certainly did want to try the health foods in this country. And I did. And it tasted of nothing on earth. The textures were bad. Everything had been cooked too much or too little. People were cooking rice, brown rice, without understanding how brown rice should be cooked and how you could keep the grains separate and yet cook them. So it was all a desire for some kind of revolution that would make you healthier. But it did not help the taste of food one little bit. So we went through that microbiotic food, if you remember, that was around the same time. And I would travel around the world and look at this thing that was spreading from America like this big tide, was red tide, was moving around the world. And it was with health food. And I went to India and found a little restaurant that was serving health food, American health food. I said, you don't need it. We have our own very healthy food. This is not what you need. But that died out amazingly. It just vanished one day. And now we have real good healthy food. People are really thinking about it in a totally different way. And that mishmash of badly cooked health food has just vanished.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I think Americans have what I call a love-hate relationship with food. We can't simply enjoy it for what it is. I mean, we're always looking for, oh, is this good for us? Does it have too many chemicals? Does it have that? With good cause, in a way. But why in this country more than any do we have this schizophrenic attitude?
I think it's that Puritanism you were talking about. You know, because it's like they don't want to like get near the sensual aspect of food.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is like, I think about like Nigella Lawson and Giada De Laurentiis. Like Giada is very, like she's more well-behaved. That's very like American. It's like she's sexy but well-behaved. And Nigella, not so much. She'll lick her fingers, you know? And I think it's like, that to me like is like a snapshot of like our cultural differences with food.
I was going to just say that I do think that Julia Child was an enormously healthy influence on us because she enjoyed cooking. You weren't supposed to enjoy cooking. It was the poor little woman shouldn't be getting her hands smelly with garlic. And we'd had this barrage from the food industry going way back to the 19th century, trying to persuade the woman to rise above all these dirty little chores. And then Julia Child comes along, and she slaps the chicken and she massages it. Somebody once said to her, why do you massage the chicken? And she said, oh, I think it likes it. And suddenly America was slapping the chicken again. It was a very healthy release. Don't you feel that?
I think there's a deeper, more serious underlying reason for this. And I think it's because the cuisine in this country is young. It has, if you look at the history of cuisines, the cuisine of China, the cuisine of India, many of the cuisines of Europe, they are ancient. They go back to something. They have a backbone. And so everything is relative to the backbone of the cuisine. Whereas what has happened in America, that whatever the native, I can't call them Indians because I'm Indian, the Native Americans or the indigenous people of this country ate, we basically disregarded the ways that they cooked the things. We disregarded them, even the salmon that they roasted, they grilled, we disregarded it till much more recently. We disregarded their foods, but took a few of them and cooked them in our own ways. But there was no cuisine that was central to the country. There was basically European cuisine, but there were so many immigrants coming from all over. And everybody was bringing their own cuisine. So what was American cuisine? And I think 250 or 300 years is not that long to settle down and find what your backbone is, what makes it American food. We're getting there, but I think it takes time to get there. And I think that's why we will go on with this. Is this good for us? Is this good for us? All this constant questioning and changing and fads and fashions, everything moving in different directions all the time, I think it's bound to go on happening for a while.
But I think we'll always be doing that because America is a country of immigrants and the new waves bring, I mean, look at that at the end of the 20th century when they opened up the doors to so many immigrants from Asia and they brought new tastes. And we're always welcoming everything and adding it to what we already have. So in some ways, it makes for a very open, healthy cuisine.
But a cuisine that's also questioning itself all the time.
Yeah. That's where you get the... Mm-hmm. I think you're right there. Do you feel that?
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, and I don't see any sort of end to it.
No.
Soon.
No, because it's going to keep changing and evolving. You know?
Having just spent a lot of time cooking a lot of recipes from other decades, you know, I realize that, like, you know, you get sort of sucked into this process of, like, getting super enthusiastic about something and then having too much of it and tossing it aside and moving on to the next thing. And, and it was sort of fun to be forced to, like, go back and revisit some things. Like, do you remember the tiramisu craze? And it was like you could not escape tiramisu no matter how hard you tried. And you ate a lot of really bad tiramisu along the way. And so by the time you're at the end of the tiramisu phase, you were just like, you're mad at tiramisu. And it's actually a really good dessert when it's made well. And so when I revisited it, it was sort of like, oh, right, we just get crazy, you know? And then, you have to, like, leave it alone for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that we were eating poorly then. It's just that we just went a little overboard.
Yeah.
We weren't eating poorly, but it was boring. And and there was, again, that sort of attitude that food was good fodder. But you didn't have to talk about it. And you were always, at least in my English family, we were always opening the windows to get the smell out. And we didn't even have garlic in the house, so I don't know what smelled.
I know so many people will say to me, I don't cook fish at home because then it smells like fish. And I'm like, and? didn't you want to eat that fish, you know? It is an interesting thing. Yeah, we're kind of always sort of trying to
throw
away. But, you know, I did notice that there's, I realized that I feel kind of worried about what's next. Because I could see in working on the Times cookbook, obviously just through the lens of the New York Times and not an all-American cooking, but there's certainly like a very like clear evolution of recipes. And we've gone from very kind of like singular technique, you know, handful of ingredients, nothing too fancy, to just having a lot more ingredients available and layering in flavors. And I think the influence is obviously from restaurants and chefs and food TV, but like now in a home cook's recipe, we expect a lot of different, you know, we expect, you know, sweet, sour, salty, you know, bitter, plus, you know, different textures, and all in this pared down package. And I think, well, it's becoming this like these perfect recipes that have like all sorts of complexity, not too difficult. But then what? Like, if we've gotten close to perfection, then what is going to be next?
Then we get tired and we move on, as you said. Mm-hmm. We move on to something else.
Yeah,
I think we've gone a little too far in the specificity. I mean, one medium onion chopped to make 2/3 of a cup. And all you're doing is throwing it in the soup. I mean, we tend to go so far in one direction. And what I'd like to see now is much more concern on the part of the recipe writer to empower you so that you taste, you judge. You don't say, well, my cookbook said. Well, the cookbook could be wrong. It's your taste that says. And I think to perhaps encourage that more would help make cooks less fearful too. I don't know why, again, Americans are very afraid of doing it wrong. If you do it wrong, you eat it anyway and you learn from your mistake.
I have a thought on that, because, and I actually wrote about a little bit of this, is that we all have senses that are more developed than others. Like my husband is a violinist, he has a very good ear. I have a good sense of sight, in the sense not I can't see too well, but I'm good at colors, I'm good at deciding what looks good with what. So it's a good visual sense. I think that would be the right word. And I have a good palate. So when I'm deciding if I go to the market and I want to, the beans look very good, I can say, all right, I'm going to have the beans with shallots and mustard seeds, let's say, and I'll sort of taste it in my mouth as I'm looking at it. Or I'll have it with garlic and this and that, and I taste that. So some people, you can't do a thing about it. You can't cultivate. I can't cultivate my husband's ear. We argue about this a lot. My husband thinks that you can learn quite a bit. And I say, you can learn only up to a point. Like, I could never play the violin. I could never do it. And I think you can trust people up to a point to figure out what to do they want. And I think I just find that some things you need to tell people, because they can't always, not everyone can figure it out. I think there are some people who can do it very well, but let's say you're the person who's not born with the greatest palate, and you're standing there frozen and stuff in front of your cooker, your cooking range, and you say, how much am I putting in? So I, in my books, my feeling always is take the guesswork out. People, if they know what they're doing, they'll do what they want to do. And people even today were telling me, I cook your recipes, but I change a few things. That's, I love that. They should do that. But if they're petrified, I'd like to give them some.
But you might not want to go there for dinner.
True. But I want them to know that this is the best that I could do with the recipe, and now it's yours, and you do what you can with it. But I'd like to offer them everything, because I feel they might be the kind of people that are petrified.
It is strange, because there's no art form that you don't learn the basics first before you take off on your own. And that's what we really need. And you need the basics in all the cuisines you're playing with. And that's a lot of basics, isn't it?
Yeah.
So
Chris Kimmel tells a funny story. Chris Kimmel, the founder of Cooks Illustrated and America's Test Kitchen, and they are all about leaving nothing to chance. And really perfecting recipes, but they send their recipes out. They've tested like 857 times to get feedback. And he tells a story about this chicken recipe, and this person wrote back and said it didn't work. It was terrible. I used shrimp instead of chicken. And so there's always exactly.
Yeah.
You can only do so much.
That's true. And you're writing for. All kinds of people,
yeah.
And
that is
hard. What do you feel about this sort of chef worship that started in this country and the influence that it's had on good or bad on home cooking?
Okay, I'm going to say what you don't want to hear.
That what?
I'm going to say what you don't want to hear.
Uh-huh.
I love it. I think it's great. Obviously, it's all these kind of crazy chef cooking shows. They're a little, over the top, but I think that it's only going to help. It invites other people who maybe weren't interested in food before to be interested in food. It's made. I mean, sites like Eater have made restaurants sport, and I mean, sure, it must be really hard on chefs because they're constantly, being criticized from all angles, but at the same time, it makes people excited about food, and I think that in the end, that it's great.
I'll give my answer is along the veins that you're saying. I have three grandchildren, and they have grown up, my kids live in this country, they have grown up in this country, and they have mixed parentage, Indian and some version of American. And they did not see comics when they were cartoons, when they were kids. They chose to sit in front of the Food Channel. And they watched, and I would hear these conversations between the littlest one and her brother, and she was saying, she was telling your mama off about something and saying that this is not this, but it's that, and using a very technical term for a particular kind of chocolate. And I said, how would she know that? But she knows it because she watches it. She knows what she's watching. And to the extent that they all want to cook, and the eldest of them, who's now just going to college, he's just started this year, I've told him that you can always be a chef. He's been cooking since he was four. But go to college, learn to read and write properly, and then if you want to be a chef, it's yours. You can do anything you want. But just get your education complete. Know your reading, writing, arithmetic. Know all that. Know your history. Know the world. Understand geography. Do all that, and then you can go and cook. But they are passionate about food, and it comes only from watching, which I don't watch, the Food Channel constantly. But as kids, they would just sit in front of that
difference.
So it really has seduced them into loving.
Yep. A lot of people's interest mm-hmm. in the art of cookery, mm-hmm. I think.
I just find that the chefs' books tend to be not very useful to most of us. In the first place, they use very expensive ingredients, and why not? It's a restaurant. It's designed to give you surprises and pleasure and drama and all these things. But that isn't what we're doing at home, and you don't need three kinds of fresh herbs in the middle of winter. And I think it kind of put people off, and we need to rescue them.
Like approachable cookbooks, but I sort of feel like, you know, with an art book, you wouldn't expect them to dumb down, but, you know, or like make the art more accessible. I think that there's a purpose. Like, I think a lot of chef's books, you know, people buy just to sort of feel inspired
It's a memoir of the evening.
And it gives you a sense of like how great food can be, even though obviously you're not going to eat like that at home. Or you can get an idea here or there. Like, I always think of Thomas Keller's cookbooks as like the recipes are crazy. You know, they're like 4 days long and 800 steps. But you know, I've learned so much. Like, I think of his Bouchon cookbook, and there are two very distinct things that I have stuck with me. One is he has this butternut squash soup. Well, everybody needs butternut squash soup, but what Thomas Keller does is at the very end, he browns butter, so it gets that like nuttiness, and then pours that into the soup, and it kind of like sizzles through the soup and infuses the whole thing. And it was like, oh, I could do this to like lots of soups, and that's such an easy little step. And he also does this really great thing. And he confies duck, and I mean, if you don't confit duck, you can't really use this, but... sorry. Speaking of inaccessible. But instead of the like classic ways, you put like coarse salt and herbs. Well, the herbs, like the aroma doesn't really have any way of kind of getting into the duck. So he grinds the salt and the herbs together in a coffee grinder. And you get this really like moss green salt, like your wrap. It's beautiful, and you rub that on the duck, and it infuses, really perfumes the duck really beautifully. And like that's something like I don't want to make the rest of his duck recipe, but I will use that little detail.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a chef who's willing to share his secrets.
Yes,
and
yes,
that's what's so often missing.
Yeah,
but I think it's even more. And again, I look at the next generations when I'm saying this, and I look at my grandson, who was home for Thanksgiving, and he went and he bought two cookbooks, and one of them was from this Danish chef who does molecular cooking. Now, I had a lot of it that was not good. Maybe I've not had the best time. But it's a book called Noma, and it's a huge book with wonderful pictures. And he wanted that book only to look at. And he just sat down at Thanksgiving. I just gave it to him. He said, you know what I really want to do is just sit in a corner and look at it. So, you know, it's inspiring kids towards something. We are used to a certain kind of cooking, and we've been raised in a certain way. But kids, their minds are going in 20 different directions. And I say, fine. First of all, I was rather resistant to him liking this book. But then I thought, you know, it's his mind. It's going in 20 directions. He may not make these things, but something will occur to him that will be fantastic. And maybe it will not even be edible food. But it's a mind going in all kinds of directions, questioning, looking at the new. And I think there's a limit to looking at the old. We do it, and we love it, and that's fine for us. But a young person looking at the future is seeing futuristic things. And I think that's quite inspiring to them. And I don't want to crush his enthusiasm. So I go along with it, though I wonder how much he learned from that book. But still, I think he should be doing it.
And it's a very different world, too, and things are changing so fast just from the publishing point of view. Because everything is going digital. That is how people want to get their information. It's quick. You don't have to have a bookcase full of cookbooks. You can haul it into the kitchen, your little laptop, and follow a Julia Child recipe for 5 pages. And it's really quite mind-boggling. I think there'll still be cookbooks because there is something wonderfully physical about that book and the photographs and things like that. But, you know, the digital world catches up faster than we can imagine, and pretty soon they're going to be just as beautiful on a machine as they are in a book. So it's sad, but you have to let it go. And it is a way of getting information quickly. How do you feel about the... Would you Google roast chicken? No.
Probably not.
But I did Google sago. And I was looking at your book, and I found it so interesting. You all know what sago is, right? Tapioca pearls, sago pearls. I was trying to master a recipe that I had grown up with, that my mother made, and when we came home from school in the summers, it would be sitting in the fridge, this nice, cool, soothing sago pudding. And I had tried cooking with sago, and I would disintegrate it, or it wouldn't get soft. And I thought, what is wrong with me? Why don't I know how to cook with sago? And I Googled sago, and everybody had 20 different ways of dealing with sago. None of them any good. None of them worked. And so I experimented for several years and never put a sago recipe in a book, because I did not know how to make it. It wasn't good. I kept testing it and testing it and testing it, and then it wasn't working. So then one day, amongst my many tests, I took the smallest sago balls that I got from the Indian shop, and I soaked them overnight, and then I drained them, then I put them in milk, and I cooked a certain amount of milk for a certain amount of time, and it worked. And the recipe's in the book, by the way. It was something that I did need to Google for, because I thought maybe somebody has the answer to sago. Now I looked at your book and saw your sago pudding, and that is the westernized version of a pudding which has eggs in it, in the New York Times book. But the way they do it is that you leave it in milk and you soak it in the fridge overnight. I thought, that's very clever. So you don't have to put it in water, throw the water away. So that was something I learned from looking at your book. But there are things that you can Google, and you will get a lot of misinformation. I would just ask this question. Now that there's so much on websites, will cookbooks be unnecessary? Not at all, because the point of a cookbook is that you write with accuracy. You test. You test and test again till it is right. And what you send out, certainly in my case, I am a one-woman band, I work by myself, and certainly what I put in a book, you can trust that I tested myself, I wrote it myself, I put it in the computer myself, so if there are any mistakes, they're my mistakes. But I have tested them. So what happens on the web is that people just throw out ideas, but nothing is tested. Nothing's properly
no. And you don't know
with
who.
Paper and pencil, no. And actually writing down measurements. Is this half a spoon, or is this more, or what am I doing? How long did I soak it? What size pan did I use? Because all these things make a big difference.
I'm not sure I totally agree with that. Because I think the thing is it's just like walking into a Barnes & Noble, into the cookbook section, and you really don't know which are the great books and which are the not-so-great books unless you've had experience and you've done your research. And it's the same thing with online. It's just a much bigger store. And, you know, I think there are so many amazing food blogs, and they really are testing the recipes in incredible detail and photographing them beautifully. It's just that the problem is sort of Google. Like, it's hard, you know, the reason a certain chicken recipe comes up is not because it's great, it's because they've done search engine optimization, you know. They've done, like, technical, you know, trickery to make sure that rises to the top. You know what I mean? Like, it's more about sort of getting away from Google and finding the sources that you trust, just like you need to do when you're in the cookbook store. It's just that, like, in traditional media, it was easier because there were, like, sort of established sources that were trustworthy, and those don't exist online. And so that's what's happening now, is this kind of new sort of new establishment forming, I think.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I guess I still have a lot to learn as far as the internet is concerned. I'm a little slow on that, so I just Googled Segal.
But you don't want to lose the individual voice and the person responsible for that recipe.
But I think there's tons of that. I think actually, because there are literally tens of thousands of food blogs.
Mm-hmm.
They're producing recipes and they have great voice and great kind of aesthetic. I mean, the thing that's kind of cool about them is that in addition to like voice, is that people can create these whole worlds that are really kind of reflect their design aesthetic, their whole sensibility, rather than having a publisher do that for them. And I think that that's really like been liberating for a lot of people, because they probably for lots of reasons may never get a chance to even pitch a publisher.
Mm-hmm. And you're alone in the kitchen, and there's a kind of wonderful coziness that happens once you have those blogs and you're consulting different people, and it's you need those mentors right there, because we didn't all learn to cook with our grandmas.
That's true.
I think we've probably used our time up, and we should have some questions. Would that be?
I think this could have gone on for quite a while, and we'd all be interested. But why don't we open it up to the audience? If you raise your hand, we will get a microphone to you. I will call on you. Gentlemen, all the way back on the left, and then we'll go to this lady on my right.
Thank you very much. May I ask the panel, is the wave of organic food coming in or going out?
Do you think organic is coming in or going out?
Organic food is coming in or going out?
I don't think it's going out. I don't think it's peaked, do you? I think that once we've been made aware of the difference in the food we buy, and if it's all properly labeled, and that's a whole nother story, I think you can't turn back somehow. And it's tough on young families, because the organic, the locally raised, is often that much more expensive. But eat less and have it good.
It seems to me like there's a backlash, because the sort of organic standards were established, and so then sort of larger, more kind of industrial farms were sort of taking those standards and just meeting them, and so it kind of lost its meaning a little bit. And so I think certainly among the food movement, there is suspicion about organic, and there are a lot of great farms who are going out on a limb and saying we don't care, we can't meet organic standards for these four reasons, but we actually are better than organic because of we raise our animals this way. And so I think that there's kind of this uneasiness about organic foods.
Yeah.
I think people want it because they're trying to get away from the chemicals as much as they can, the hormones, the chemicals. We're trying to get away from them. But as Judith said, like my own daughter, who's a school teacher, she wants to eat organic food but can't afford to buy it. So she said, I just stopped. She tried when her kid was small. And she said, I just can't afford it. I just can't think of it that way anymore, because the prices are so high. And I think there are people who will increase the organic farms. There are people who will start farming seas and oceans. I think a lot of things are to come, and they haven't quite come yet, but I think they're going to find other areas where they can perhaps grow purer food. And the oceans might be a place that they might be turning to, as one reads. I'm not sure about it. But I think we can't get away from wanting organic food, because we want to save our bodies. We're already living longer, but I think we want to save our bodies from all the harm that's been caused. And I know my husband, he was talking to a doctor, and he was saying that my husband has had a couple of cancers, and the doctor was telling him that it's the meat. It's so full of hormones that what do you think is going to happen? Either you stop eating it, or you're careful about what kind of meat you buy. So you really have to decide what you want to do, and it's a tough decision. It's a really tough decision for most of us to make right now.
Maybe over here.
Grow grass-fed beef in Vermont.
Yeah, that's it.
A comment and a question. I am so tired of hearing caramelization, caramelized on the television cooking shows. My question following up on this discussion you've just had about organically grown foods is, what is your opinion of genetically modified foods?
How do you feel about genetically modified foods?
Modified.
Oh, no, no.
What do we mean by modified?
All right. I'll try, but each of you has to jump in, too.
Okay.
Because I don't know. My instinct is that it can't be good for you. But it may be all right. I can't imagine it being good. But
no.
We haven't gone through the tests. We don't know how things should be done. I mean, if you look at ancient civilizations, like China, for example, they were doing things to the seed before they put it into the ground. Sometimes they put all kinds of very nasty, dangerous, killer stuff on it to keep the insects away so they would not eat the seed. And we are doing similar things, but in a more organized kind of way. And whether it's good or not, I really don't know.
You know, it's a very murky area, but it is true, as you say, that we have been modifying seeds as long as civilization. We probably wouldn't be here. It's just when it gets in the wrong hands.
I don't really have a fully formed thought. I mean, it sort of scares me.
Yeah, I mean, I think with GMOs, there are political issues as well, because when seeds are bred, and then there's a limitation in terms of their ability to reproduce, and people can't afford to.
Seed.
People then have to
buy seed
on
an
annual basis.
That's what's happening in India.
How does it taste, and is it good for me?
Right.
And then there's
so
the political
Indian
aspect of it.
Farmers are rebelling for this reason,
right,
that they were given this modified seed by certain companies in this country, and then they can't get the seed that they need for the next year, and they have to buy more modified seed, and they can't afford it.
Yeah.
So that's been a killer in many ways for the farmers, because they've been killing themselves. It's not they can't grow the next year's crop, so they just kill themselves.
Another question? Yes, lady on our left. About
there's
10
one
months.
There.
Hi, thank you. My question originally was from Madhur, about how you feel about the quote-unquote maybe Americanization, or how we consider Indian food in America. And when people talk about, you know, for me, a great Indian restaurant, I'm like, I don't want to eat another chicken tikka masala. But I guess to the entire panel, maybe what we consider the Americanization of ethnic foods, but maybe how that may be both a positive and a negative. I guess we see that also with the art of French cooking, perhaps, too.
When I got involved with the restaurant for the first time, I never owned a restaurant. I'm just a consultant to a restaurant. And we were thinking of what the menu should be. I thought the menu should all be dishes that we love in India and eat at home, that have never been in a restaurant, and that are what I consider to be really authentic Indian dishes. And they said, well, everybody asked for chicken tikka masala. I said, we don't want it in this restaurant. So what is chicken tikka masala? Half of it is real, in the sense that you make little cubes of chicken and you cook them in a tandoor. And the way it developed, which is probably in Birmingham in England, was that they had these leftover pieces of chicken that nobody had eaten. So then they said, what can we do with these leftovers? And they made in an Indian wok, they made a sauce with tomatoes, onions, garlic, ginger, things like that, and then threw in the leftover chicken tikkas, as they were called, into this sauce, which had masala or sauce, and served it to people, and people sort of fell in love with it. And I said I would not have it, so they said, okay, we won't have it, and it wasn't on the menu. And then one day I went and somebody was eating chicken tikka masala. I said, what is that? And I said, but madam, he asked for it. So they were so afraid not to give people what they wanted, that they began giving people chicken tikka masala, and by the sort of backhand route, it crept into the restaurant. But to answer your question in general, certain things are inevitable. Whatever country you are in will influence the food. And I don't even resist it. Because when Tabla opened, for example, in New York, I don't know if you know the restaurant, but it's a sort of a mixed Western and Indian restaurant, which is about to close, actually, in December. So people kept asking me, what do you think of it? I said, it's inevitable. There are people who will love Indian food, there are people who will not love Indian food, and will be very happy with a hybrid version of Indian food, but it's a little Indian, but it's not so unusually Indian that they find it alien. So it's inevitable. Everywhere where you bring in a foreign cuisine, it's going to see changes. And so it's going to exist on many, many levels. It'll be in some places totally authentic, whatever that word is. Then in other places it'll be semi-turned around. And then in other places it'll be fully, consciously mixed. Now what we do at Dawat, very, our food is really authentically Indian, but we plate it in a Western way very often. So we are ourselves making changes at that restaurant, even though I stood up for authentic Indian food for a long time. And then I also said I would never use the word curry. And what is my newest book in England? It's called Curry Easy. So, after a while you give up. You say, this is what people understand, this is what people know. Go with it. You just can't fight things for year after year after year. Anyone else answer the question?
Well, I'm just interested in that whole sort of debate of, like, do you conform or do you, like, go, like, my way or the highway approach. And I was just thinking, like, I feel like there's an argument for both, but I think of, like, Alice Waters. And, I mean, at her restaurant, it's like you there was a menu and there were no substitutions. I think of, like, the soup Nazi, you know. Part of the reason he was popular is because he was, like, tough. And it was like you had to eat his way. And so there's, you know, so I think some of that that kind of adaptation of cuisines has more, you know, it has to do with running a business, you know, rather than necessarily, you know, and pleasing, and the issue of pleasing customers, which mm-hmm. is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. On our left again, fourth row.
Okay, challenge. What's your favorite midweek? There's nothing in the larder. I'm tired. It's late. My husband's starving. Meal to prepare.
Who are you asking?
I'd like an answer from each of you.
Okay. She said, what kind of meal? You have nothing in the larder. It's midweek. And what? Your husband comes home. He's hungry. He's tired. He wants dinner quickly. What would you make? I would probably make a pasta of some sort, which is very quick and easy to do, and you don't need too much for it. Anything lying around in the fridge, plus garlic and a red chili, will, as far as I'm concerned, do it.
I agree with that. I'd do pasta or some kind of a risotto or a bean dish or something. But there shouldn't be nothing in the larder. I strongly believe in thinking ahead, and if you're making a little tomato sauce or cream sauce or chopping up some onions in a Duke's ale, do extra and have those little gems in the freezer.
Yeah, we do pasta. Like, we always have sort of the makings of the matriciana around. Eggs.
Oh, we're about eggs? That's something in the larder.
Yeah. Yes. But, you know, there's another thing. I try and grow all my own vegetables in the summer. And I have a big garden, and I freeze a lot of stuff. And I make tomato sauce. In other words, I just puree the tomatoes and freeze them. So I always have, I have my blueberries in the freezer from my summer. I have my vegetables in the freezer. I have various things, and the tomato sauce, and these are always there. So I'm also like you. I'm prepared for 2 years of being lost in the house. I'm an Indian. I'm afraid of things that can happen. met from the grassroots. I'm, my husband thinks I'm crazy, but I'm prepared for, you know, 2 years of drought.
Any other survivalists out there? Maybe about 10 minutes back in the way.
Hi. Can you talk about the evolution of cookbook writing? Amanda, I just recently acquired your book and find your prose to be delightful and personal and humorous. And admittedly, I don't have a lot of experience with reading the introductions to cookbooks. But I wondered if it tended to be in the past more just formal and formulaic, and if this is a recent trend.
I got
she was addressing Amanda.
Not the rest. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. You should probably weigh in here, since you have way more experience with cookbooks than I do. It was about sort of like voice and cookbooks and how it changed. I think it certainly has. I mean, it's funny because Craig Claiborne, which people really loved and felt very connected to. If you look at his book, there's almost no writing. But it was like his sensibility is what people felt like they knew. And that was the person that they liked and felt close with. And I think that that's really interesting and quite a talent that he had. I think Mastering the Art of French Cooking is, I think, another example where, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's not a ton of writing. It's really about the recipes, right? And the way it's
made. It's about the technique and why you're doing it.
Yeah.
The ingredients you should buy and how to brown something and not let the pieces of meat touch each other and to dry them so that you learn from making a boeuf bourguignon really the fundamentals of making a good, what we'd call, stew. And it's the difference between okay cooking and cooking with finesse that Julia always would say, soigné. And so I feel very strongly that the voice is important.
Oh, whoops. Oh, there we go.
Let's see. Technical difficulty.
There we go.
And more on.
I feel very strongly that the language of food is important and that the voice should be individual. That is what gives the character to the recipe, the sense that this person who's telling you how to do it knows something. And I think we've gotten recipe writing reduced to an ugly formula that isn't even English when you say, in a bowl, combine the first mixture with the second mixture. In the first place, in a bowl doesn't belong up front. And what was that first mixture? Oh, I heated a little milk and I put some sugar in it. That must be the first mixture. How did this happen? I mean, it doesn't take any more words to say the warm milk, does it? And I sort of blame magazines and periodicals for, you know, because they want it as succinct as possible. But succinct does not necessarily make a good recipe. So I really try with my writers to say, let me hear how you do it. Do you plop it in the bowl? Oh, plop, that's what I do. Or, you know, it just needs that voice, that warmth, that enthusiasm. And I think the detail. Once you've learned the detail and it's imprinted in your brain, you don't have to read it. But because it's there, you know how to do it. But I feel we need that.
It seems to me that British food writers have a lot, they're like much more comfortable with kind of like using colorful language and sort of original verbs, you know, for actions. And I think of Fergus Henderson, whose book Nose to Tail Cookery was a big hit and sort of prompted the whole sort of, you know, movement back to eating lots of different parts of the animal. And, you know, there's a recipe, he has this bone marrow, roasted bone marrow with parsley salad, and he says, you know, combine the parsley and shallots and let them get to know each other. And, you know,
yeah, like that's nice.
Nice little details like that. Which, and I think, you know, Nigella Lawson is very good at that. And, you know, and Honor, you have a very personal voice, I find, in your books. You know?
Yeah, I've never written any other way. I wasn't a food person. So I came into this completely from the outside. So when I first started writing, I was an English major. So I just started writing. And I never thought about shortening it or lengthening it. It had to explain what the food was and explain what I was trying to do. And so I just wrote like myself.
But you observed yourself and what you were doing, and that was the miracle of that first invitation to Indian cooking.
Yeah,
you really felt,
knew what I was doing.
We'll take one more question in right here.
For Amanda Hesser, my question about food blogs. Do you write a food blog, or how does one, so that's the first question. The second is, how does one find a quality food blog on the Internet? Do you
find a what? A good quality,
because there is, as everyone was mentioning, there is a random quality to the Internet. How can you find good food blogs?
Well, just a very basic way. Actually, people are constantly putting out lists of the best food blogs. And so those are actually kind of helpful. So the Times of London, or the London Times, puts out like the 50 best food blogs in the world list every year. And that's handy. I feel like that's, you sort of have to in some way like Google lists of food blogs. it's very inefficient, but it is. But you know, actually the other way, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the very basic way, which is that you find a good one, and they do something called a blog roll, which is like a list of other blogs that they like. And you find, you can very quickly find yourself traveling from blog to blog to blog, and that's a good way. And so, I have a food site with my friend Meryl Stubbs, and it's sort of a community. So it has a blog element, but it's not strictly a blog.
And a book soon to follow on. Wow. Terrific writers, terrific evening. Please join me in thanking Madhuri Jaffrey, Judith Jones, and Amanda Hesser. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.